True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
On the morning of Friday, August 16th in 1996, Marissa Moody brought her 6-year-old son to the very impressive home of Janet and Perry March to have a play date with their 5-year-old Sammy March. The March family seemed like the picture-perfect family, but Marissa never really felt comfortable around Perry March. He was intimidating and really just snubbed her at every opportunity. Janet March, 33 years old, was an accomplished artist from a very privileged upbringing. It wasn't terribly unusual that Janet wasn't there for the playdate that day. The March children had a nanny. The only thing that seemed off that day to Marissa was the presence of a rolled-up rug lying on the floor near the kitchen entryway. She'd never seen it before. And when she returned to pick up her son later that afternoon, the rug was gone. Perry claimed that Janet had left the home for a 12-day vacation. But then after 12 days, there was still no sign of her. Homicide detectives became convinced that Janet's 100-pound body had been concealed in the rug that day. Join us at the quiet end for the disappearance of Janet March. According to homicide detectives, Perry March killed his wife Janet during an argument on the evening of August 15th, 1996. His father, Arthur, and brother Ronald were seen as possible accomplices in disposing of Janet's body. But with no body and no murder weapon, the case was nearly impossible to prove. The court of public opinion found Perry March guilty from early on in the investigation, but it would take years for his true character to be exposed. So what do we have for a beer today, Dick?
Well, interestingly, we have a Nashville beer.
Very well done.
This is a homestyle IPA from Bearded Iris Brewing, which is in Nashville, one of the places we visited when we went to CrimeCon a couple years ago.
That was fun. I think that was like 4 or 5 years ago now.
Yeah, I should say a couple. Time flies.
It does.
But this is a nice brewery, a very nice beer. It's a New England IPA. Hazy gold color, small white head, a little bit of lacing, big, huge citrus aroma. When you taste it, it's mostly grapefruit, but also some orange and maybe some tangerine. A very nice fruity beer, medium-bodied.
Sounds great. Why don't you open that up for us?
I will.
So the nice thing about being down here in New Mexico is spring comes early. And things are really warming up now, even though it's still February.
Well, it has been nice the last few days, although maybe you're not aware that we have snow forecast for the weekend.
No, I'm not aware.
Okay.
And I'm just going to pretend I didn't hear that.
You didn't hear me say that.
All right, come on over and start telling this story, because this is a story that I read about years ago, and it's always been fascinating to me. So I'm looking forward to this discussion today.
It's an interesting case, that's for sure. So Perry March is the oldest child of Arthur and Zipporah March. Perry was born in East Chicago in 1961. The name March had been shortened by Arthur from the given name of Markovich. Arthur had graduated college and served in the military as a pharmacist in a military hospital. In the late 1950s, he visited Israel, where he met his wife-to-be, Zipporah Eliason. They married quickly and returned to Chicago. After Perry was born, they had another son, Ronald. Then they had a little sister named Kathy. Now, the family wasn't wealthy, but they were certainly financially secure, and they seemed like a reasonably happy family, despite Arthur's tendency to move from one job to another. In 1970, when Perry was a 9-year-old, his mother died of a drug overdose. She had been prescribed pain pills for a head injury, and they found a near-empty bottle out on her bedside table. That's a tough thing to do, a little 9-year-old kid.
Yeah, I think Arthur lied to the children about it for quite a while. But Arthur's a character. Arthur was a storyteller from way back, and we'll see a lot of that in the story.
After Zipporah's death, Arthur sold their house in Chicago and he moved the kids to their vacation home, which was on the shore of Lake Michigan. And even though Arthur was a social being and he had quite a few friends, he turned out to be a devoted father. He gave his children what they needed to be successful in life. So Perry and Ronald became attorneys. Kathy became a dentist. That's a pretty good outcome for three kids.
Yes, I think so.
They all did very well, but Perry was the one who seemed to be able to find trouble later on in his life.
Yeah, he got good grades back in school, and he was involved in tennis, wrestling, soccer, karate. He even earned a black belt while he was still in high school. He went to college at the University of Michigan, where he majored in Asian studies, and he became fluent in Chinese. Janet March was born Janet Gail Levine in 1963. She was the first child of Lawrence and Carolyn Levine. She had a little brother named Mark. Lawrence Levine, her dad, was a native of New York who earned his law degree in Michigan. He built an insurance defense practice in Nashville, and that would grow into the firm of Levine, Orr, and Garasiati. Janet was an artist from a young age. She had her work exhibited in some of Nashville's restaurants and even at the Jewish Community Center. So Janet met Perry at the University of Michigan, and they quickly became inseparable. After Perry graduated, he relocated to Chicago to work at a brokerage house. Janet would join him 6 months later. Perry was then accepted at Vanderbilt University Law School, and Janet's father was pretty happy about that. He even offered to pay his tuition and expenses, even though the couple weren't even engaged at that point. But Janet's parents were very pleased with her choice of Perry.
That they were. And we might note that Vanderbilt Law School is in Nashville, so they'd have the in-laws around, right?
Absolutely. These were very involved parents.
So in 1987, Janet married Perry. She'd been waiting for him to propose for years, but he didn't. Why not?
We don't know.
Just too comfortable having her hang around?
Yeah.
Anyway, she finally proposed to him. And that was a good idea because being with Janet not only gave Perry a beautiful, talented wife, it also gave him a life without financial worries. Once they were married, Janet's parents, Lawrence and Carolyn, wanted to help them as much as they could. So they gave the couple money to buy a house near them in Nashville. And he, as you said, he went to Vanderbilt. In 1988, Perry took an offer to be an associate in the prominent Nashville law firm of Barry and Sims. So, man, you know, he's got this powerful in-law couple looking over him. He's married this gorgeous woman who's an artist.
He was pretty much set for life.
And he's got a job in this prestigious law firm. Holy cow, he's set.
Well, you would think so, wouldn't you? But his dad, Arthur March, by this time wasn't doing well financially. He was having some problems. His home was being foreclosed on by the mortgage company, and soon he'd be homeless. But Lawrence Levine came to the rescue again. He purchased the house and allowed Arthur to continue living there. But then within a year, he had to sell the house because Arthur wasn't paying his rent and didn't even seem to be making an effort. So Arthur then moved to Nashville, too, to be near Perry and Janet. And when he arrived in Nashville, he had no place to stay. So the Levines to the rescue once again. They invited him to stay in their home. They loaned him some money to get back on his feet. But still, Arthur ended up in bankruptcy.
Boy, that's pretty generous of them. I mean, they bought the house for him.
Yeah.
And he didn't pay rent. And they had to sell it. And they still loaned him some money and let him stay with them. Very trusting people.
Trusting. And I think they really liked Perry. He was like a son to them.
At least at that point.
Especially because he'd lost his mother at such a young age. He really bonded with Janet's mom. And they kind of took him in, like almost like an orphan, an adult orphan. But then Arthur went ahead and made plans in 1991 to move to Mexico. And he wanted to live in the beautiful Lake Chapala area. And this area was really popular with retirees because it was much more affordable to retire there than in the United States.
Now, the co-workers at his law firm saw Perry as a rising star. He was considered to be on his way to a partnership in the firm. But 3 years into his employment, Perry was asked to resign after an investigation revealed that he had written sexually explicit love letters to a female paralegal. On July 19, 1991, the paralegal, who for our purposes we'll call Gloria, found a letter on her chair in the Barry and Sims office. This was an unsigned, typed, single-space letter on several pages, and it was a very graphic proposal for oral sex.
Okay, so several pages. I don't understand how you could write that much.
I could write that in like two sentences.
Exactly, yes.
But anyway, I guess he was a true author, and he wanted to put a romantic love letter in.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't go well. I mean, there were multiple mentions of licking and sucking and kissing and nibbling and stroking her body, and geez. And the writer did admit to being a married man, but he justified himself because his marital sex life was boring, routine, and horrors. It was old.
So this was actually quite upsetting to the young paralegal.
I can imagine.
Gloria was well respected at the firm and had no interest in Perry's proposition. So she gave the letter to her supervisor. Management of the firm hired a private security firm to find out who had written the letter, because I'm sure they were terrified of a big sexual harassment lawsuit.
Oh, absolutely.
So using CCTV, the security firm caught Perry leaving another letter on Gloria's chair. But then she got angry because Perry wasn't immediately fired, and she left the firm. Within weeks, Perry was allowed to resign, and he had to agree to pay $25,000 in a settlement to her.
And once again, his father-in-law came to the rescue. His corporate law firm of Levine, Matson, Orr, and Garasiotti gave him a position there. And while he was employed by them, he represented multiple local businesses.
Yeah, and I don't think that the father-in-law was aware of why Perry had to resign. He didn't tell him the truth about that.
So maybe he wouldn't have been so generous.
Well, I don't know. He might have just forgiven him and been that generous. It seems like as long as Janet loved Perry, the parents would do anything for him.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm sure it got even more serious once they had children. He's the father of their grandchildren.
Right.
So Perry and Janet had their first child, their son Sammy, in 1991. And then in 1994, they had their daughter Zippy. They began making plans to build their 5,300-square-foot Forest Hills dream house. And Janet, who was very artistic, designed the home. There were already indications that she was unhappy in her marriage to Perry, but her parents put up the money for that $650,000 property. That's a lot of money for any house, but in the 90s, it's even more.
Yeah, this has to be some mansion, doesn't it?
Yes, 5,300 square feet, and in a very exclusive area as well. But Janet had confided to her parents that she didn't trust her husband and that he had badly mismanaged their finances. The Levines advised her to keep her assets in her own name, just in case the marriage ended in divorce sometime down the road.
Good advice. Now, in the months before Janet disappeared in 1996, Perry had been making plans to leave his father-in-law's firm. Now, he had been negotiating to lease office space from the law firm next door to Levine's firm. He told them that he was intending to open his own practice so he would no longer have to share his income with Levine's firm. And according to some investigations, Perry had asked his clients to delay paying him until he had set up his own firm. That's certainly not cool. It might even be illegal, huh?
Yeah, I didn't look up if that was illegal, but I thought it might be. But it's certainly not a good thing to do.
No.
I mean, especially after all his father-in-law's done for him.
Right. He's been well cared for by his father-in-law.
Oh, absolutely.
And he's going to turn around and fuck him.
Well, I mean, the more some people get, the more they want. It doesn't always work out well.
Yeah.
He felt very entitled.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah. So on August 15th, 1996, the temperatures would reach 90 degrees with 100% humidity.
Summer in the South.
That's right. So really, just a miserable day to be outdoors. Janet and Perry were living in their dream home on 4 acres on Blackberry Road in the upscale community of Forest Hills. When their children Sammy and Zippy were not with their parents or their nanny, they spent a lot of time with their grandparents, the Levines. The Marches had been married for 9 years at this point. They argued quite a bit, but always tried to take it outside so the children didn't have to overhear it. Janet did have a temper, and some simple disagreements often led to some more intense arguments. And also Perry was described by his associates as an aggressive litigator with a pretty short fuse.
So two people that like to argue.
Yes, and I think they both really like to control things as well.
Yeah.
I mean, Janet was not an easy person.
Janet had spent a good part of that day overseeing the work of two cabinet makers. They were there to complete warranty work on countertops that had been installed sometime earlier, and they had to be fixed because Janet was very demanding, sometimes thought to make up unreasonable demands. So there's these guys working there, and they're getting yelled at by the lady of the house, and she was supervising their work and got so outspoken. That's a good term, isn't it? Outspoken?
Yeah.
Instead of argumentative? Anyway, Perry had to calm her down. And the cabinet makers, they just wanted to get out of there as soon as possible. So they've got done and left the house just after 5. These two men, along with Perry and the kids, were the last people to see Janet alive.
Well, according to Perry, he and Janet had a nice quiet dinner with the children that evening. And after eating, Janet had gone into her studio to work on an art project. Then, between 7 and 7:30 p.m., Perry put the children to bed in their upstairs bedrooms. When he returned downstairs, he claimed, Janet had packed 3 bags and she was ready to go. According to Perry, he and Janet then had an argument. And at around 8:30 p.m., Janet just said, "See ya," and put her bags into her 1996 Volvo. She'd taken between $4,000 and $5,000 in cash, along with a bag of marijuana and her passport. So what else do you need?
I know. Money, weed, and the passport.
That's right.
Let's go.
So Perry would later say that Janet told him it was none of his business where she was going. She told him that she would return in a few days, Perry said, and then that was the last he saw of her. So what's he to do? That's all he knew.
That's it. As reported in an investigative series in the Nashville Scene, Perry called his brother Ronald at 9:11 p.m. Ronald was living just outside of Chicago in Illinois, and he and his wife were about to go to bed when Perry called. Perry and Ronald spoke for only 3 minutes. Then Perry called his sister Kathy in Michigan. That was at 9:14, and that call lasted 4 minutes. And it wasn't until midnight when Perry contacted Janet's parents. They were last to know, weren't they? Or among the last to know.
Well, he waited a while, didn't he?
He did. Now, he later would say that he didn't call them earlier because he and Janet had promised one another that they would not involve the Levines in their marital problems. But she's missing. This isn't just a problem. Anyway.
Well, according to him, she just had left.
Before calling them, he called several Nashville hotels to see if Janet had checked in for the night. Then when he couldn't find her, he finally decided to call the Levines to see if she had driven to their house to spend the night. Perry said he told the Levines that they should call the police and report Janet missing. That's interesting. Why wouldn't it be him? And according to him, it was the Levines who didn't want to call the police because it could be an embarrassment to her after she returned home.
Yeah, so there were contradictions here because the Levines said that they just believed Perry that she had left on her own and that they should wait for her to get back. And Perry said that he wanted to call the police, but they didn't. So we don't know what really happened. But Carolyn Levine, Janet's mom, would later say that she had believed Perry quite a bit. She didn't have any reason not to. They loved him like a son. She soon, though, became suspicious because Janet disappearing was so totally out of her character. If she had left Perry, she would have taken her children with her, too. So over time, Perry's story steadily lost credibility, and he did change some facts. Janet had not told Perry that Marissa Moody was bringing her son over the next morning for a playdate. She also had not told him about the plans for Sammy's 6th birthday party that was just days away. So it didn't make sense.
Not so far, it didn't. So Marissa Moody showed up at the March household the next morning. That was August 16th, and she had her 6-year-old son with her to have the playdate. Now, Marissa would later say that she never liked to visit the Marches, but she went for the sake of her son, who was good friends with Sammy March. Marissa's a single mom, and she says she just didn't feel accepted by Janet and Perry, and she felt that the couple had disrespected her many times for, to her, unknown reasons.
Yes, I kind of get the vibe that they were a little snobbish.
Well,
that's the vibe I got.
I would get that vibe if I'm going over there for a play date with my kid and the mother's not there, just the nanny.
Yeah.
And say, okay, something's not right.
Well, as Marissa pulled up to the house at 10 a.m., she saw the little girl, Zippy, playing in the yard with her nanny. She smiled and waved at them, walking up the steps to the front door. And this house was in a neighborhood of pretty much, we could just call them mansions. They were all set well back from the road with acres of land providing privacy. Sammy answered the door, excited to see his buddy, and Sammy invited them inside, so Marissa and her son followed him down the hall toward the kitchen. The interior of this home was almost all light hardwood, including floors, railings, and doors. Very clean, very organized. The house cleaner, Deneen Beard, had already been there for a couple of hours. So the only thing out of place to Marissa was a large, dark-colored rug which was rolled up on the floor. And as she talked to Sammy, he was sitting on the rug, bouncing up and down a few times. So the nanny told Marissa that Janet was not home, and she waited outside of Perry's study for him to come out. But he never even came out and acknowledged her. He told Sammy to tell Marissa that it was okay for her son to stay and play for a few hours. But this didn't surprise Marissa. This was just kind of how it went.
Right.
She was just used to being disrespected by Perry. So she told her little boy that she would return a little bit later and said goodbye to Sammy and left. When she returned later to pick up her son, she noticed that that rolled up rug was gone. After Marissa and her son left, Perry drove his children over to his in-laws, and they discussed Janet, and he told them that they had been arguing. Perry suggested that they go out and search for Janet's Volvo. So after they checked that Janet had not gone to her brother's house in L.A., Lawrence Levine and Perry drove together to the Nashville airport, and they drove through the parking garages there, but didn't see her car anywhere. So the Levines began calling Janet's friends, but no one had seen her. Still, they didn't call the police. Later, the Levines would say that Perry didn't want to call the police, and of course they regretted that they waited so long. But Perry left Sammy and Zippy in the care of their grandparents for most of that weekend. Then he began talking about a to-do list that Janet had left for him. He claimed that Janet had left for a 12-day vacation, and she planned to return home for their son Sammy's birthday party on August 27th. So there's a little change in the story.
Right. Now we've got a little bit of a difference. Now, according to what Perry told the Levines, Janet had typed up the list on the home computer before she left on the evening of the 15th. Perry said that she made him agree to complete the list and even had him sign it.
I think I'm going to do that with you, Dickie. Give you a list and have you sign it?
Yep. But as long as you don't have a date on it that says it has to be completed by, I'll be happy to sign it.
Okay.
It had a centered title, said Perry's Turn for Janet's 12-Day Vacation. And the list included feeding the children three times a day. Well, that's kind of understood, isn't it?
You would think
so.
Or
would he forget?
Well, either he forgot things a lot or she was super controlling or, in my mind, a little of both.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably super controlling. So feed the kids, pay the house cleaner, pay the nanny, do the laundry, pay the bills, and give the children a bath every day. You don't need to give me a list for that. I can remember that stuff.
Yeah, I know. It's a little weird. It's a little weird. But, you know, the whole thing is that we don't even think Janet wrote that, right?
Right.
It was recorded on the computer as being saved at 8:17 p.m. on the evening of the 15th, the night she disappeared.
Now, at the end of the weekend after Janet left, Perry called his father, Arthur, and this was Sunday evening at 5:11 p.m. They spoke for 4 minutes. Then he called Arthur back again at 10:18, and this time they talked about Arthur driving up to Nashville to help with the children. Lake Chapala, where Arthur lived in Mexico, was a 4-day drive to Nashville. If Perry expected his wife to return in less than a couple weeks, having Arthur come out didn't make much sense, did it?
No, it doesn't to me, not at all.
If he's going to go by this story that he's got this letter that says I'm gone for 12 days, why does Arthur need to come up and look for her?
Well, he didn't have a letter that said 12 days. Well, I guess it was titled 12-day vacation. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make any sense to drive 4 days and then stay for 8 days and drive 4 days back. That's a lot of driving.
Something like that, right.
So whatever happened in that phone call, we're not privy to what they said. But Arthur left Mexico for Nashville, nonetheless, and he believed he arrived at the house on either August 21st or 22nd. Since he had been called by Perry on Sunday the 18th, showing up on the 22nd would fit this scenario.
Yeah, it would, easily.
So Perry had begun telling everyone that Janet planned to return home for Sammy's birthday party on August 27th, right?
Yeah.
But the RSVPs for the party came back, and Perry saw that the party date was actually Sunday, August 25th. Which makes sense. You're not going to have a kid's party on a weekday.
No, you're not. But I guess Perry, because like you, I'm thinking this is a fictionalized letter that he wrote himself, right?
Yeah, I thought that right off, yeah.
So he just couldn't remember what day the birthday party was supposed to be.
Well, and I believe the 27th, his actual birthday, was the first day of school, so that wouldn't have worked out anyway. And normally these things happen on a weekend, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's when you have birthday parties.
Sure. So, if Janet had actually said she would return for the party, she should have told him a 10-day vacation, not a 12-day vacation.
Uh-huh.
So there's another little thing that's off. But Perry and the Levines decided that they had no choice but to go ahead with the party, and I'm a little stunned by this. Of course, many of Sammy's friends and their parents were invited, and it seemed difficult to cancel on such short notice. But she's gone, and I keep thinking the Levines must have really believed him, because why would you do that?
I know. At this point, this is 10 days into her being missing.
Right? Yeah, and this isn't a woman who's going to miss her son's birthday.
So I'm not sure. Are they trying to make it seem like there's nothing going on?
Yeah. And, you know, it's like that sometimes. In your real life, you don't think something like this is going to happen to you or your family. So I think it's fairly common to have some denial, at least for some people.
Yeah.
But they also agreed to tell everyone at the party that Janet was in California visiting her brother. And she had been advised not to fly home because she had an ear infection. So they said after the infection was gone, she would fly home to Nashville. And everyone accepted the explanation without question.
Well, sure, it's pretty plausible.
But to go so far as to lie about where she is, it's just...
I know.
They're maybe unwitting accomplices in this for a while.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. So on Thursday, August 29th, and now we're 14 days into missing, right?
Yeah.
Perry and the Levines finally went to the Nashville PD and reported Janet as being missing. Perry gave the police the same basic story he had told other people. Investigators first got Janet's bank and credit card information to find out if she had withdrawn any money from her accounts or used any credit cards or written any checks in the past 2 weeks. But there had been no activity on any of her accounts, which I would take as not a good sign.
No, that's a very bad sign, because how could she be living anywhere without using any of these things?
Yeah. I mean, if you're going away on your 10 or 12-day vacation or whatever, there's got to be some activity.
Absolutely. So they talked to Janet and Perry's friends. Perry was described as a practical man who could be quite arrogant at times. Janet was considered to be very intelligent, but sometimes flighty. She was one that was often late for appointments. But she was a hard-working and a talented artist, and lately people had noticed that Janet seemed a bit depressed. Even though she had what looked like the perfect family, the perfect life, really, with everything she could ever want, she had seemed like something was off with her life. Perry had been spending more time away from home in the past year, and he seemed quite bored with his wife. He'd been working out at the Jewish Community Center gym so much that people thought he was a single guy.
Well, there's, see, you can figure out what's going on. He's having affairs.
Well, there's no proof of that, but there could have been a little bit of a midlife crisis, but, perhaps.
Yeah, he seems bored with his wife. He's working out more.
He's at least looking to have affairs, if not having them.
Yeah, but he is also reportedly seen around the city with other women.
That's true.
Not his wife.
Right,
and that was in recent months. One person had even seen him with a good-looking blonde walking arm in arm. Then another person saw him having an intimate dinner with an attractive brunette. Well, Perry, you're getting around. But Perry said these were all business-related sightings.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
That's right.
But it turned out that Perry had been spending some nights away from home in the 2 weeks before Janet disappeared. He spent these nights in various hotels in the city and always returned home before the children woke up in the mornings. He admitted to having some marital issues, and he said that he and Janet had been seeing a psychiatrist to work on things. Janet had actually complained that she had taken on a much larger part of the responsibility for the children and the home, while Perry went out and entertained clients. So their house cleaner told investigators that she had seen a book about divorce on Janet's bedside table earlier that summer. So it seems that she was considering divorce.
Yeah, and the police were looking for any indications that Perry March had a propensity for violence. And as they were doing this, they found a woman who claimed that Perry had assaulted her when they were both students at the University of Michigan. She said that he had hit her in her face when he became jealous of another guy. Perry said that the woman was a slut who gave him crabs before he dumped her.
Now, see, any guy that would talk about a woman like that, I don't have a good feeling about.
You've automatically turned me off anyway. She just says, I got hit because he got jealous, and he says, she's a slut. She gave me crabs and other STDs. Good guy.
And the woman said she never even had sex with him.
Oh, so they were non-sexual crabs.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she hadn't reported his assault at the time, but then she said she felt compelled to come forward when she heard about Janet's disappearance in the news. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It was Saturday, September 7th, when Janet's Volvo was spotted at the Brixworth Apartments near Vanderbilt University. This was a 6.5-mile drive from the March home, and the police estimated it was a 13-minute drive. The car looked like it had been parked there for a while without being moved, and alarmingly, her purse, passport, wallet, and credit cards were left inside. They also found some clothing in the car, including a bathing suit, sundresses, and socks. But one thing that seemed really odd was that Janet's sandals were just neatly lined up on the passenger side floorboard, and that just didn't seem like a normal thing to find.
Right. Well, and the other thing is the fact that her passport, wallet, and credit cards were in the car would sort of shoot the theory that she was on a vacation. That would shoot that down.
Well, that would immediately lead me to worry that something bad had happened to her, of course.
Absolutely.
You don't go anywhere and leave that stuff behind.
Perry was cooperative. He allowed the detectives into his house for a search, where they found absolutely nothing. The cleaning woman told police that when she arrived to clean the house the day after Janet disappeared, it already looked spotless, almost like somebody had cleaned it up and emptied all the trash bins and stuff. So I'd be suspicious there, too.
Yes, because normally they didn't do that. She did all that.
Yeah, that's the house cleaner.
So about a week after that search, construction workers from a project underway near the March home reported that they had noticed a strong foul odor in the area in early September. It smelled to them like something had died and was decomposing. When detectives returned to Perry and asked to search his house a second time, though, he refused. On the advice of his attorney, he also refused to take a polygraph exam. He said that he had been prescribed Xanax and Zoloft for anxiety, which could interfere with the results. But I think any attorney is going to tell you not to take it. So, unable to get access to his medical records, police had to take Perry's word for being on those medications. But interestingly enough, Perry told several other people that he didn't take any prescription medications. Then examining the to-do list that Perry said Janet had left for him was something that police found really suspicious. For one thing, it was written more in the style of Perry, with uppercase letters, lowercase letters, and punctuation. When Janet typed up an email or something, she normally just used only lowercase letters, even when she began a new sentence. Also, it was an unusual thing to type up a to-do list. There was no history or evidence of her ever doing that before.
Right, and as we read it before, it was so elementary. It's obvious that you need to feed the kids and wash them and pay the bills and stuff. You don't need a to-do list for that.
Yeah, that really doesn't sound like something she would write. If she made him a to-do list, I think it would have been different.
Yeah.
Plus, we know the title was wrong. She wasn't going to leave for 12 days and miss her little boy's birthday party. And now we have the things left in the car, so it's really not looking good at all.
Not for Janet. Now, in her interviews with police, Marissa Moody said that it was Janet who had planned the play date for August 16th. Perry contradicted her, saying that it was him who had planned the play date. He also claimed that Marissa had not entered the home that morning. But if their suspicions were correct, Janet's body had been hidden inside the rolled-up rug. And if that were true, then her 5-year-old son had been bouncing up and down on his mother's body.
So that's horrifying.
Kind of grisly.
Well, you know how kids are restless and they do that kind of thing.
Oh, I can totally picture that.
But just thinking that his mother was in there, it's horrible. But Perry claimed that the rug never even existed. He later told a 48 Hours correspondent that the only rug he owned that resembled the one described by Marissa Moody was a long runner. So if Janet's body had been inside, he said, she would have looked like a small sausage rolled up like an appetizer.
Ew.
So just the idea that he would talk about his wife that way is upsetting. The statement is so cringeworthy. It's graphic and it's disrespectful. I don't like it. It's a bad sign. So police believed Marissa, not Perry. At this point, he's not credible because he's changed his story.
He keeps tracking around all over the place. So
exactly.
In mid-September, the police got a search warrant for the March home. They processed the wood floors for blood. They searched for fingerprints, palm prints, any prints, collected fireplace ashes, looked in the bathrooms, the basement, and the attic. Also, the surrounding land and garage were searched. Didn't find anything. But if Janet had been killed with a karate blow, or if she'd been strangled, there wouldn't be any blood for evidence.
Yeah, remember, Perry held a black belt in karate.
Yeah, local karate instructor Jerry Williams told the Nashville Scene that any person who holds a legitimate black belt would know several ways to kill a lighter person in just seconds without spilling any blood. He said death could be caused by a chokehold, a blow to the sternum, or putting pressure on pressure points. Or, as in Kill Bill, the five fingers of death or whatever they are.
Yeah. Well, there's also strangulation, which is a very common way for this kind of murder to occur.
Yeah. Well, a chokehold, same thing.
Yeah, yeah. So he could have temporarily hidden Janet's body nearby. That would explain that smell. He could have wrapped her in the rug and hauled it away to dispose of it. Detectives questioned if Perry had delayed calling his in-laws until midnight, so he had the time to hide the body, type up the to-do list, drive the car to the apartment complex parking lot. So he could have dropped the car off and rode home on his mountain bike. The Volvo was large enough to carry his bike. When investigators examined the March's home computer, then they discovered that the hard drive had been removed. Perry had been out of town for the weekend of September 14th and 15th, just before that search warrant was executed. And while he did that, Arthur stayed behind at the house alone. But Arthur denied removing the hard drive, claiming he didn't even know what a hard drive was.
That's how I do it.
I think most people wouldn't know how to do that.
Well, I wouldn't know how to remove a hard drive.
No, and I don't think Arthur would either.
I'd have to take the whole computer and remove it.
Yes. And why not? I don't think it would look any less suspicious to get rid of the whole thing at that point.
Right.
So let's take a short break here to talk about our sponsor, Best Fiends. I'd like to take just a moment to tell our listeners about my new favorite game, Best Fiends. Now, I have a good share of guilty pleasures, Married at First Sight and The Bachelor, to name just two. But you know what I have exactly zero guilt about? My love of playing Best Fiends. I call Best Fiends boredom's worst nightmare. You know how I love a good puzzle? Well, Best Fiends is a match 3 puzzle game like none other, with literally thousands of levels and new content added all of the time. I've been playing for a couple of months now, and I'm a little obsessed.
Excuse me?
Okay, a lot obsessed. For me, I love the cute creatures that are the fiends, and the adrenaline rush I get each time I beat a level. True crime can be a really stressful topic, and Best Fiends is just good, clean fun that helps me de-stress between research and recording sessions. I'm at level 60 now after a couple of months of playing, but anyone can play as little or as much as they want to. You can even get some friendly Best Fiends competitions going with your friends. It's casual gameplay that fits into my life as a great way to binge, or just pop in when you have a few minutes to spare.
I've found that it's a great way to pass the time while you're waiting for your doctor's appointment or your dental appointment.
Or the DMV.
Or that too. Any place where you're in line.
So if you never get tired of solving puzzles, this is good news for you. With Best Fiends, the fun never ends. Just don't blame me if you become slightly obsessed. Download Best Fiends today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
So while Perry was in Chicago that weekend celebrating Rosh Hashanah with his kids, he was also making plans to relocate there. The Levines suspected that was going on, so they filed for an emergency order to prevent Perry from removing the kids from Tennessee. But before the papers were filed, Perry left Sammy and Zippy to live with his brother Ronald in the Chicago suburbs.
Yes, so the Levines went to the Nashville Juvenile Court for an order to allow them visitation with their grandchildren every weekend beginning that October. And Perry was subpoenaed to give a deposition in civil proceedings on Janet's disappearance. He invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. That was on the advice of his attorney, not too surprising.
Of course.
When police learned about Perry's possible sexual harassment suit at Barry and Sims for writing the letters to the female paralegal, then they found out about the $25,000 settlement. Perry'd been behind on paying this settlement. When Janet disappeared, he'd only paid half of it off. So detectives believed that Perry had hidden this debt from Janet, and they began to theorize that she may have confronted him about a letter he had sent just 2 days earlier to that paralegal, explaining to her that he was having trouble coming up with the money he owed to her. So she could have threatened divorce. She could have threatened to cut him off financially, and that might have been enough to set Perry off during their argument.
That's a possibility. And then later that year, detectives discovered that Perry had replaced the tires on his Jeep Cherokee, and this was just days after Janet disappeared. Perry claimed that he had replaced the tires because they were worn out and bald. But the manager at the tire shop said that the Jeep's tires had at least 50% tread left on them. And it was very unusual for someone to replace tires that were perfectly fine.
Yeah, so, what would the reason be? And he said he wanted a different brand, but why?
Well, maybe tire impressions could incriminate him.
Well, sure, yes, but I'm saying what would his excuse be? He can't say that's the reason.
No, he can't. He said he needed them because they were bald.
Yeah, but they weren't bald.
Well, that's his story.
I'm just wondering what he told the tire people.
If they said
these are fine, what was his reason?
He said, I just need new ones so you won't catch me for killing my wife.
Okay. Well, police wondered if Perry had been worried about the tire impressions, so I think you're right on that.
Yeah, that has to be.
Sure. According to the articles in the Nashville Scene, which were written by reporter Willie Stern, Perry's brother Ronald and father Arthur were being looked at as possible accomplices. Both of these men claimed to have no involvement in Janet's disappearance or in a cover-up. Perry spoke out publicly, saying that he had been wronged by the police, his in-laws, and other sectors of the community.
Poor me. I'm being persecuted.
Exactly. He compared himself to Richard Jewell, the Atlanta security guard who was named by the police as the prime suspect in the Olympic Park bombings. And then Richard Jewell had been cleared and was kind of a hero in a way, right? Because he'd been trying to save people.
He was looking to get people out of the area.
So Perry's trying to compare himself to that. So he really is comfortable playing the victim.
Yes, he is. At the request of the Nashville scene, a local psychiatrist examined several excerpts from the sexually charged letters received by the paralegal from Perry March. Now, the scene informed the psychiatrist that the letters were allegedly written by Perry. The psychiatrist had never met Perry, but analyzed the letters using informed speculation that was based upon medical training and experience in psychiatry. The psychiatrist said that the excerpts provided a reasonable basis for informed speculation. So all this gobbledygook just means that she's reading these letters cold and interpreting them.
Based on her own knowledge.
Right.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm always skeptical of stuff like that.
Well, I don't think it proves anything, but it's interesting just to get the opinion of a professional.
It can be. The writer of the letters, according to the psychiatrist, showed incredibly bad judgment. And the psychiatrist expressed concern for the letter writer's psychological well-being. In describing the letter writer, the psychiatrist used adjectives including antisocial, manipulative, and unstable. The letter writer's scheming, according to the psychiatrist, was juvenile, and the sort of thing an 8 or 9 year old might attempt.
Well, that's an 8 or 9 year old who's got a lot of sexual knowledge. It's a little worrisome.
That's true.
But they were quite graphic.
It's not a good letter, not a good take on Perry.
No, not at all. The psychiatrist noted that the sexual references in the letters focused exclusively on the man pleasing the woman and not on his pleasure. And I don't see anything wrong with that, but the letter writer's descriptions of sexual activity were self-degrading. She said that the focus is always on her orgasm and his is never mentioned. So she pondered that maybe he was impotent or afraid of being impotent. But for me, that's just a stretch. Maybe he was just trying to lure her in with that kind of talk.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have the letters to look at.
No, we don't.
And so we're just going on other people's interpretations of them or, you know, what they said was in it.
Sure, but this is a professional person, so a little more weight than just any old person, I would say.
I'll give you that.
Yep. But in the letters, the writer also describes himself as an excellent husband, which is a laugh. The psychiatrist doubted that the letter writer was such a good husband, and according to the psychiatrist, Perry was apparently making an effort to prove this to himself, you know, kind of a self-justification. The letter suggested that he thought that his wife was in the way of his having what he perceived as a satisfying relationship.
I'd have a good relationship with my wife if only she wasn't there.
Exactly. So the excerpts also included evidence of significant narcissism, which that does not surprise me at all.
No, we keep coming back to that in all these murder cases.
I know, but it's true.
It really is.
I mean, it seems like we're overusing that term, but not really.
No.
So in summary, the psychiatrist pretty much just concluded that the writer of the letter was a very sick man. So it wasn't a good take on Perry's mental state.
No, it wasn't. It doesn't mean anything because it was just kind of an interpretation. It's not in a court of law or anything like that.
Oh, no, no. But just for interest.
Interesting to read.
Sure.
Now, in December of 1996, Perry was ordered by the court to allow regular visits between his children and his in-laws. And an attorney was also appointed to represent the children's best interests. So the Levines were supposed to have a 2-hour visit that same evening. But when they showed up, Perry and the children weren't there. They were told by a relative that Perry and the children had left the state.
Yeah, so I just wanted to bring up with you this whole idea of grandparents getting custody or visitation through the courts. What do you think about that?
Well, why shouldn't they?
Well, I just think that parents decide how they want to raise their children. And if their parents, the children's grandparents, want to have anything to do with them and have visitation, that should be up to the parents, unless there's something wrong with what the parents are doing.
Well, the something wrong is that this is a guy who might be accused of killing his wife.
In this case, yes, I would say that that is reasonable. But I'm not sure if grandparents should always be able to sue for visitation, there might be a damn good reason.
No, I agree with that.
Not all grandparents are great people.
Right.
Just like not all parents are great people.
Right. But in this case, we're talking specifically about Perry and his kids.
Yes. So it's very much on a case-by-case basis.
Yes.
So 1 month after that, in January of 1997, the Janet March case was transferred to veteran homicide detectives Pat Postiglione and Bill Pridemore. Both had been involved in earlier searches of the March home, but now they would take a more active role in the investigation. Postiglione began his career in law enforcement as a patrol officer back in 1980, and he made detective in 1987. And we've seen him on, he has his own show on Investigation Discovery. It's called Deadly Recall. And I think the whole premise there was that he has one of these memories where he doesn't forget a thing.
Right.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
Photographic memory type thing.
Yeah. So Janet's case was not the first case that Postiglione and Pridemore had worked together, but this was one of their most complex and longest-running investigations. Although one thing did not point directly at Perry March for the murder of his wife, it was this trail of multiple little things that were really adding up to his apparent guilt. Detectives were determined to keep at it until they got answers, because they felt pretty certain that he had killed Janet. By 1997, the news was out that Perry had been fired from his father-in-law's firm for allegedly embezzling funds.
Huh. So he gets, well, not fired, but he's asked to resign from the first firm because of sexually explicit letters to the paralegal.
Well, it was pretty much resign or get fired.
Right.
Yes.
And then he had been fired from his father-in-law's firm for embezzlement, possibly.
Yes, so.
Nice guy.
He's got problems. And this is the guy that had done so much for him. So one of his former clients had been indicted for money laundering and racketeering. And then there was some evidence that Perry had helped another client with tax evasion. A witness told the authorities that he had seen Perry and this former client arguing in public after Janet had disappeared. So Perry soon couldn't find any gainful employment in Nashville or Chicago, at least not as an attorney.
Right.
And the Levines did everything they could at this point to keep him from getting any of Janet's assets, including the house in Forest Hills. Because now they've decided that he killed their daughter.
Yeah, they're firmly on that side. Janet's mother, Carolyn, searched the Forest Hills house in early 1997 after Perry had moved to Chicago. Perry had taken most of Janet's possessions, but Carolyn did find two envelopes with Janet's name handwritten on them. Both envelopes contained typed letters that turned out to be the originals of copies Perry had sent to the paralegal back in 1991.
Although I don't know why you'd make copies.
I don't know either.
Although I'm thinking maybe the paralegal made copies and sent them to her.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Carolyn notified the police, who came up with a theory that Janet had found these letters, confronted Perry about them, and was killed the night she disappeared.
Right, exactly. So Perry had left Nashville and lived in Chicago close to his family members, but he wasn't able to escape his past there either. In May of 1999, Perry moved himself and his kids to a lakeside town in Mexico, which was about 30 miles from Guadalajara, to live with Arthur March. Most of the expatriate community was made up of Canadian and American retirees, and of course they benefited from the lower cost of living and the warmer climate. Arthur was known around town. He was quite a character, and he'd lived there long enough to learn the language and know many people at the market and in the bars. Perry easily learned Spanish. Remember, he was good with languages. He'd learned Chinese back in college.
Yeah. Some people can pick those up.
I'm the worst at that. I can barely speak English. But it didn't take long for Perry to meet a 27-year-old Mexican woman who had three children from a previous marriage, and she was just a real knockout. Within weeks, Perry moved his children in with her. Her name was Carmen, and her children. And Perry enrolled Sammy and Zippy in a bilingual private school.
And Perry had also become close to a Mexican-American man whose name was S. Samuel Chavez. Chavez claimed to be a graduate of Purdue and the Indiana University School of Law. He advertised that he specialized in immigration issues after being part of a law firm in Guadalajara. So Perry and Chavez formed a company, and they claimed they were well connected with the Mexican authorities. Now in Mexico, all that meant was that you had the ability to bribe government officials.
Yeah, and it turned out that Chavez had lost his license to practice law in the state of Indiana after felony convictions for providing false information on a credit application and a bankruptcy filing.
Oops.
Still, Perry announced a business connection with Chavez, and they ran ads for a private development and investment firm that was seeking investors for a state-of-the-art clinic and emergency treatment facility. They said that opening this facility would give the area's seniors top-quality health care closer to home, so they wouldn't have to drive all the way to Guadalajara. But Perry was disbarred after allegations of fraud and embezzlement were made by his former employer. His father-in-law's firm also alleged that he had not provided records to a client who had requested them, and that he had lied to improve his chances in a lawsuit. So as his business grew with Chavez, unhappy clients and investors began filing complaints against them. Some of them posted details of both men's shady pasts on the internet, and they even put up posters in the community called Not Wanted Posters, trying to get them to move away.
Not wanted.
So as more people figured out what Chavez and March were up to, things began to get ugly. The community didn't want these dishonest guys living in their community.
In January 2000, the judge in the Levine's wrongful death lawsuit that they had filed against Perry ruled that Janet March was dead and that Perry March was responsible. And 2 months after that, the court awarded the Levine's $113.5 million in damages. Perry's ordered to pay them. Good luck with that.
Well, I don't think they ever expected to get the money, of course.
But they got the guilty verdict.
Absolutely.
And that March, Perry married his girlfriend, Carmen, and they had a baby together. Carmen told the CBC correspondent that Perry was just this great husband who was perfect for her. And Perry called his blended family the Brady Bunch.
Isn't that cute?
Cute enough to make me puke. Now, when asked what he had told his children about Janet, he said he told them that Mommy had left home and they don't know what happened to her.
That's really helpful.
Then Arthur March talked to a reporter, and he filed a petition stating that it was Janet's father, Lawrence Levine, who killed her to keep her from exposing Lawrence's history of sexual abuse. Jeez.
So these guys are just fucking scumbags.
That is just the lowest thing about you could do.
Isn't it? I mean, they've already lost their daughter. Do you really have to do that to them? Even if they did lose their daughter and blamed him and he was innocent, wouldn't you be more understanding than that, I would think?
Maybe.
Yeah, well, not Arthur March and certainly not Perry March.
Nope.
That spring in May of 2000, the Levines showed up at Perry's Mexican home. There had been changes to the Tennessee state legal code that gave grandparents the right to pursue custody of grandchildren whose custodial parent had been found responsible in a wrongful death suit. Uh-huh. So this is more the reason why they did it than money.
Yeah. There was talk that the Levines had actually had some influence in the wording of the new legislation.
They were fairly powerful people.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But it's still unclear how a Tennessee law could be applied to people living in Mexico. Perry absolutely, positively refused to allow the Levines any visitation with Sammy and Zippy and sent them away.
Now, to me, that's cruel as well.
Yeah, but the Levines were persistent.
Yes, they were.
So a month later or so, Perry got picked up by immigration officials while the children were at school. And while that happened, the Levines went to the school and convinced the school to release the children to them. Arthur March heard about this, and he's racing to the airport to stop them from taking the children back to the United States.
Can you imagine what these kids are thinking?
I'd be terrified.
It's so traumatic.
Especially, I mean, he actually caught up with them on the road and pulled a gun on them. But they managed to get on an airplane with the grandkids and flew back to Nashville.
But it has to be so confusing. It's just so heartbreaking for these kids.
Horrible.
They're going to believe their dad and their grandpa Arthur, and then their grandparents, the Levines, are coming, and they're getting a whole different story. So I really hope they got some therapy. This had to be incredibly difficult. and Perry was released by the immigration officials that day, but he was too late to stop the Levines. Then, back in Nashville, the Levines had just 39 days to get permanent custody of Sammy and Zippy. Perry contacted the media and said that the Levines had broken Mexican laws and international treaties by taking his children to the U.S. He contacted a Nashville attorney who practiced civil rights law. The Levines' 39-day court-ordered visitation with their grandchildren ended that July 30, 2000, and they filed paperwork in Tennessee asking that Perry's parental rights be terminated. Now, that's difficult to do.
I would imagine.
The Nashville court granted the Levines temporary custody. When the children weren't returned to Perry, though, his Mexican lawyer filed a motion to have them returned immediately. And after weeks of efforts, a petition for the return of the children was successful. A federal judge ordered the Levines to return the children, and they were reunited with Perry in April 2001. So it took some time.
Well, this always happens. Nothing moves quickly in the courtroom.
That's true. I just keep thinking of those poor children, though, and what they had to be going through. So the Levines did file an appeal, of course, but then the Supreme Court declined to hear it. After the kids were returned to Mexico, Perry and his wife Carmen decided to open a cafe because his business with Chavez was ending and not ending well.
No, he's going to be fortunate to stay out of jail for that.
Absolutely. In 2003, he was able to get his wrongful death judgment overturned because the court found that the Levines had offered no new evidence that Perry had killed Janet, and his misbehavior did not warrant a default judgment against him, because he had offered to be deposed by telephone from Mexico. Still, this victory in the civil court would not deter Postiglione and Pridemore from continuing this homicide investigation, full throttle.
Right, they're still looking. In 2004, a grand jury did indict Perry on murder, tampering with evidence, and abuse of a corpse. The public didn't get this knowledge until 2005. And then the authorities were able to arrange for Perry's arrest in Mexico and his extradition to Tennessee for trial.
Well, yeah, I think they didn't want to tip him off until they could actually get him.
Right. So in August of 2005, Perry was arrested, brought to a Los Angeles jail, and was going to be extradited to Nashville.
So you might think at this point the case winds down, but no.
No, we still got things to do.
There's still a lot of twists and turns. On Friday, August 12th, Postiglione and Pridemore picked up Perry March at the Los Angeles jail, where he had been held for 9 days, and he was escorted to Los Angeles International Airport for a flight back to Nashville. While riding the shuttle bus from the car rental office to the Northwest Airlines terminal at LAX, the three men only engaged in small talk. Perry took the window seat in coach, Postiglione sat next to him in the middle seat, and Pridemore took the aisle seat.
This is on the plane?
Yes.
We're not on the shuttle anymore?
No.
Okay.
They were on the shuttle. They got on the plane.
Yeah.
So Postiglione and Pridemore had already decided before the flight that they would take the position that they would not speak to Perry unless he spoke to them first. And Perry did sit silently for the first 45 minutes or so of the flight. But he just couldn't keep quiet. He started a conversation with the detectives and asked them about a newspaper photo of a woman at the 2004 Olympics in Athens, Greece. He said that the woman in the picture looked like Janet and that he had sent a copy of that photo to the prosecutor's office in Nashville. This photo had been taken from a video of spectators watching the games. And Perry was claiming that he sent the photo to the prosecutor's office, proving that Janet was there in the crowd. But, you know, the Levines had examined this photo, and they had said that that woman was not their daughter. And if it was, they would say so, because they would like nothing more than to have their daughter back. Postiglione told Perry that the lead had been investigated, and they knew it was not Janet in the photo. Perry then suggested that Janet might be alive in Quebec. He began asking about the case, calling it the Janet incident. So, kind of,
jeez.
Yeah, distancing himself a bit there. But he also wanted to know what the police had on him, how strong the case against him was, and he even asked if they had any physical evidence. Of course, Postiglione told Perry that they wouldn't discuss the evidence with him, but Perry continued to talk and ask for more information.
He denied any involvement in Janet's disappearance, but then he began to talk about a deal where he would plead guilty and do 5 to 7 years in prison. Postiglione told Perry that they couldn't speak for the district attorney's office, and he had no authority to offer a plea.
Well, and Perry should have known that. He was an attorney.
He's a lawyer.
Even though he wasn't a criminal attorney, he had to know the basics.
Yeah. Perry told Postiglione that he was excited to meet with the DA in order to start talking about a deal. He also said he would plead guilty, even though he wasn't guilty, in order to avoid a lengthy prison sentence.
Then Perry asked the detectives if they had a witness who saw him kill Janet. He wanted to know why it had taken them 9 years to indict him, and he also asked if there was any new evidence. Of course, Postiglione didn't answer. And then Perry told him that Janet was not the perfect angel that the media had portrayed her to be, and he was not a monster.
Well, we've got to work the crowd here a little bit. Then a few minutes later, Perry said he was concerned about the influence that he believed the Levines held over the DA's office. Perry said that his ability to impeach some of the state's witnesses would help him decide whether he would agree to a deal or not. He told the detectives that a guilty plea would be easier on everyone involved. Talked about the expense of having a trial. Boy, they covered a lot of ground on this flight, didn't they?
Well, it was mostly him, from what I've read.
He said that a guilty plea would bring closure to Janet's family. Then mentioned a newspaper article about a person who had reported seeing him with a dead dog, and he insisted that the article was not only ridiculous, but had been published to smear him. And he told Postiglione that he had not wrapped Janet inside a rug, and he had not thrown her into a dumpster, and he had not thrown her into an incinerator. So he's covering everything.
Yeah, so this dead dog thing, I guess they were thinking it could have been her, and the person could have interpreted it that way.
Sure.
But after they arrived at the Nashville International Airport, Perry was transported to the Criminal Justice Center in downtown Nashville, and that's where he was processed through night court. The charges of second-degree murder, abuse of a corpse, and evidence tampering were read to him. And he didn't say much at this point, aside from agreeing that he understood the charges against him. Then, for his own protection, he was at first placed in an isolated cell. He'd had a lot of attention in the media, so they didn't want to put him in danger from other inmates. Being a wife killer is not appreciated by most of the other criminals.
On August 17, 2005, Perry, who was dressed in a dark business suit instead of a jail-issued orange jumpsuit, was brought before the Davidson County Criminal Court. He entered a not guilty plea to each of the charges and was led out of the courtroom. His bail had been set at $3 million, an amount that he was not going to be able to come up with. So after leaving the courtroom, Perry was escorted to juvenile court to continue a custody hearing for his children. Sammy and Zippy had been staying with Perry's brother Ronald, and the purpose of the hearing was to allow both sides to present arguments about who should have custody. The Levines' argument was that they should have custody due to the fact that Perry had been deported from Mexico and arrested for his wife's death.
That sounds reasonable to me.
Me too. And guess what? A week later, the court granted temporary custody of the children to the Levines.
Perry's attorneys later filed a motion to exclude from evidence any and all statements that Postiglione and Pridemore alleged that he had made to them during their flight from L.A. to Nashville. Perry claimed that he was not given his Miranda warnings and that the detectives engaged in custodial interrogation after he had asserted his right to counsel. After the court cited that his claims were without merit, Perry's motion to exclude evidence of his in-flight conversations would be denied as well.
Okay.
So Perry shared a section of the jail with sex offender Jeremy Paul Duffer, who was awaiting trial for 7 counts of child rape, 4 counts of aggravated sexual battery involving a child, and 2 counts of sexual exploitation of a minor.
Nice guy.
Yeah, he'd actually been having sex for several months with a 12-year-old boy, who he had befriended and groomed. He'd found him at a store where he worked. Also in that same section of the jail, though, there was Nate Ferris, who was in jail for aggravated assault in a domestic fight he had with his girlfriend. So according to his girlfriend, Ferris had been drinking and had taken some Xanax. He had been on house arrest, and when he wanted to take off, his girlfriend said that's not a good idea. Then he became angry and grabbed her by the throat. He hit her in her face, and she grabbed a kitchen knife. But Ferris got the knife away from her and held it to her throat, threatening to kill her. So Ferris was a pretty intimidating figure. Big guy, his head was shaved bald, he had a goatee, and he had this tattoo of a question mark right on the middle of his throat. Also, I think some other neck tattoos. He had opened cases in Davidson County Criminal Court on charges of attempted murder and aggravated robbery. So he had his own fair share of problems.
He certainly did. Now, Perry and Ferris became friendly with each other not long after Ferris was locked up, and they began to talk to each other on a regular basis. Now, it didn't take long for Perry to reveal what kind of a person he really was, and also for him to make a really, really big mistake. If Ferris could make bail, Perry wanted to know if he would murder Carolyn and Lawrence Levine for him. And then in exchange, Perry would give him money and set up a new life for him in Mexico. So he told Ferris this is a win-win situation we both gain from him. He would have a better chance of being acquitted if the Levines were out of the picture.
I don't think he's really right about that, but
no.
We'll get into that.
Life in Mexico, according to Perry, was like a paradise, and his father would help Ferris make the transition there. So Ferris agreed to help Perry, at least initially, with this plan. But he soon began to worry about what he would be getting involved in. So Ferris called his mother to ask for her advice, and she told him he needed to call the authorities.
So it's a good thing he listened to his mother, huh?
Yeah, he must. Here's this brute of a guy who's just a total beast, and his mommy tells him to do something, he does it.
Yep, exactly, right. I just don't understand how he thought killing Janet's parents was going to make his case any better. It's just stupid,
don't
really.
Don't ask. I have no idea.
Really stupid. So Ferris's mother notified Lawrence and Carolyn Levine of Perry's plan. So good for her. Then under the direction of the DA's office, Postiglione and Pridemore provided Ferris with a digital recorder. He agreed to record his conversations with Perry about the plan to have the Levines murdered. So now they're going to set him up pretty good.
They certainly are. So after they recorded conversations between himself and Perry, Ferris had given the police enough to arrest Perry for conspiring to commit first-degree murder. Perry gave Ferris his father's phone number in Mexico, along with a list of code words to use so Arthur would know who it was. So Ferris soon gets transferred to the jail in nearby Williamson County. He told Perry that he'd gotten released on bond, and Perry gave Ferris the Levine's address. Now, after the transfer, there were 5 recorded conversations between Nate Ferris and Arthur March. Arthur told Ferris the best time of day to kill the Levines, where he could get a gun, what kind of gun to use, and make sure you wear gloves the whole time. He then explained how to get to his town in Mexico, and he said, well, the weather's warm and the women are hot.
Yeah, so Arthur's kind of gross.
Arthur is. I mean, he's got to be, what, some old dude in his 60s or 70s?
Yeah.
Hot women.
Well, not only that, but he had been in the military, but he lied and exaggerated, saying that he was like a Navy SEAL or a Marine or something. So he was just kind of a big liar as well.
Yeah.
After Ferris was transferred out of Perry's jail, Perry befriended another inmate, and he talked with this guy about his family and the life he missed with his wife in Mexico, Carmen. Then in one of their conversations, Perry told him what had really happened on the evening Janet had disappeared, at least according to this inmate. So according to later testimony by this inmate, Perry told him that he and Janet had argued that night. She said she was going to get a divorce and take everything, and then the fight became physical. Perry hit her over the head with a wrench, and he claimed that he then disposed of her body by burning it and pouring the ashes into a lake. But there's no evidence that this was true.
No. Soon after that, Farris called Arthur, and he said, "The job's done." Arthur went to pick him up at the Guadalajara airport. Now, when he arrived there, guess what? There's an FBI agent waiting for him. So Perry had been arrested and charged with 2 counts of solicitation to commit murder and 2 federal counts of conspiring to commit murder. Arthur was then charged with the same offenses, but he was a fugitive.
Well, yeah, he was hiding out in Mexico.
Right.
But after hearing about the indictments, Arthur said that he would not return to Nashville willingly. When confronted by law enforcement from Nashville, he was told that if he didn't surrender himself, he would be extradited. And his response was, "I don't go peacefully. I don't go like Perry. There'll be blood shed somewhere, whether it's theirs or mine. I'm a big boy. I take care of myself and carry my cane. That's all I do."
Whoa.
So yeah, he's kind of a joke, right?
Well, you think so.
Kind of an old guy who likes to play tough guy. Although he certainly was capable of doing bad things.
Yes, he was.
His cane was supposedly just a sheath for a razor-sharp blade that was 2 feet long. The paperwork to begin extradition proceedings against him was filed with the state, the U.S., and the Mexican governments, making it only a matter of time before Arthur would have to go back to Nashville to face charges.
And this happened in November of 2005. The DA's office announced that Perry would be tried in 3 separate trials. So the first trial was scheduled to begin in April 2006. This was on a charge of felony theft, which was about the embezzlement for allegedly stealing between $10,000 and $60,000 from his father-in-law's law firm while Perry had been employed there. Then his second trial, scheduled for June 2006, was to face the charges for plotting to have the Levines murdered. And the third and final trial, scheduled for August 2006, and Perry's going to have a busy spring and summer, isn't he?
Yeah.
Was about his charges of second-degree murder, abuse of a corpse, and evidence tampering in the disappearance of Janet.
Yeah, so January 5th, 2006, officers showed up at 8 a.m. at the donut shop that Arthur frequented on an almost daily basis. He had some cronies there. They'd hang out and chat and drink their coffee.
Yeah, isn't that what the old guys do?
Well, yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Arthur's Mexican resident status was revoked because of a demand from the U.S. consulate based on his indictment for his participation in Perry's plot to have the Levines killed. Arthur's indictment and arrest warrant were enough to revoke his residency and have him deported as well. If Arthur was acquitted on the charges, he would again be able to return to Mexico. But you know, when they were going to take him, he resisted. He tried to attack one of the agents with a knife, like one of those little knives that was part of his belt buckle.
Jeez.
So he really did see himself as some kind of
badass.
Absolutely. But I'd be pretty shocked if this 70-something old little man started
no kidding.
Fighting like that.
Yeah.
Whoa.
In April 2006, Perry was convicted in this first trial for embezzling $23,000 from the Levine law firm. Then in June, he was convicted of the 2 murder conspiracy charges. So far he's 0 for 2.
Yeah, things aren't going Perry's way.
Then the trial for Janet's murder and the 2 charges related to disposing of her body started in August. Now, Arthur March was too ill to travel to Nashville from the federal facility where he was being held in Kentucky. Arthur said he was too ill to testify against Perry, and his attorney asked for him to be declared unavailable for the trial. So they decided that the jury would still be allowed to hear him and see him on a videotaped deposition.
Well, I just have to wonder if he just didn't want to face his son.
Well, probably. You think?
I think so. So the jury was made up of 9 white people and 3 African-American people. They were transported by bus to Nashville, and they were sequestered at an unknown location. The prosecution's opening statements went over Perry and Janet's marriage from early on. Janet had planned to have a consultation with a divorce attorney and had an appointment for the day after she disappeared, in fact. As expected, prosecutors presented circumstantial evidence based on the facts of the case. The jury heard testimony from Janet's mother, as well as many of Janet's friends, in which they claimed that Perry had been emotionally abusive toward Janet. There was also testimony about the marital problems, the impending divorce, and Perry's sexually explicit letters to the paralegal. The jury was shown the deposition of Arthur March, who had taken a plea deal on the murder conspiracy charges for a reduced prison sentence. He confirmed that Perry had killed Janet on August 15, 1996. He had gotten rid of the hard drive from the computer for Perry. And that surprises me, because I really didn't think he'd know how to do that. Although I'm sure it's not rocket science. You could figure it out pretty easily.
It must not be.
No. Anyway, a few weeks after the murder, Perry had taken Arthur to a wooded area and gave him directions to where Janet's body could be found. He gave Arthur a large trash bag, and Perry waited in the car. This is so bizarre to me.
Yeah, this is...
Not just that they're hiding a body, but the father-son relationship is strange. Because he sent Arthur out there, and Arthur found Janet's body, that's what Arthur said, brought it back to Perry's car, and the two of them drove to Kentucky. But Perry went into a motel room they rented and slept, while Arthur drove to the other side of town in his Jeep. He buried Janet with the bag in a large pile of brush. When prosecutors took Arthur out to the site later on, he'd not been able to locate the body for them, though. But still, investigators did believe his story was credible, at least at the core.
Yeah, I guess there's enough stuff in there that they said, okay, this probably happened.
Yeah, I mean, he was known to make up stories and exaggerate things, so I don't think you can believe him 100%. But there's no reason why he would try to get his son in trouble. He'd done all this for Perry. If it wasn't such horrendous stuff, you'd almost have to admire the devotion to his son.
Yeah, right.
Right? But considering what it is, of course, we don't.
So the defense's evidence was both scant and weak. Correctional officers testified against Perry's fellow inmates, who had testified to conversations they had had with him. And that didn't prove much of anything. A videotaped interview of Sammy March giving a TV interview was played. And in this interview, he said he remembered his mother kissing him goodnight on the night she disappeared and waving to him as she drove away from the house.
But, yeah, I think he was fed that story.
Well, yeah, the video was contradicted by three prosecution witnesses. His kindergarten teacher testified that Sammy had been sad when he went to class on August 27th, and that's his birthday, so you expect him to be happy.
Exactly.
And the teacher said when she asked what was wrong, he told her that his mother had left 2 weeks ago and he hadn't had a chance to say goodbye.
So sad.
Then the children's guardian ad litem said that Sammy had told her that on the night his mother disappeared, he heard his parents fighting, and then when he woke up the next morning, his mother was gone. Carolyn Levine testified that Sammy never spoke to her about seeing his mother drive away.
Yeah, so... That Perry really had no boundaries to use his son like that. It's disgusting.
Whatever it takes, baby.
Horrible. But the trial lasted just 1 week. The jury reached their verdict in just 10 hours. Perry was found guilty on all charges. He was sentenced to a total of 56 years in prison. His father, Arthur, was sentenced to 18 months with supervised release afterwards. But then the judge in his case rejected that sentence and he gave Arthur 5 years. Didn't matter, though, because Arthur died in prison just 3 months later from an illness. He was not in great shape.
Perry appealed his conviction, mostly basing this on the trial court being an error when they didn't suppress his conversation with Postiglione and Pridemore en route from Los Angeles to Nashville. He argued that this was a violation of his rights against self-incrimination and to the assistance of counsel. Perry also claimed that the letters he had written to the paralegal were prejudicial to him. Well, of course they were. The appeals were heard in 2010, and his conviction was upheld. In 2011, Perry was denied permission to appeal his case with the Tennessee Supreme Court.
Right, so I kind of had to think about, was it fair to have those letters in evidence? But I decided it was, because it shows the marriage, what his relationship was like with Janet.
Yeah.
So he later filed a habeas corpus petition in federal court. He focused on his constitutional issues with the conversation he'd had on the plane with Postiglione. He argued that the court had erred in assuming that he initiated this conversation. Also, he argued that the situation of being under arrest and being transported in custody was inherently coercive. Then in 2013, that petition was denied.
Well, you know, he's just trying to cover up tracks. He willingly, apparently, engaged in the conversation.
Well, yeah, we don't know, but according to the detectives, it was all him. I would think an experienced detective would know.
Yeah.
Not to bring that up.
Wouldn't they?
Yes.
So Perry's serving his sentence at the Morgan County Correctional Complex in Wartburg, Tennessee. Perry remains quite litigious, and has even sued the Department of Corrections and their food provider for religious discrimination. Mostly, he was complaining about the quality of the kosher meals that were provided to him.
See, entitled. To the very end, entitled.
He volunteers helping other inmates with their appeals, and Perry is going to be due up for parole in 2038.
Well, according to Perry, his daughter Zippy is still in occasional contact with him, and the last that was written by him about her was that she was considering a career as a nurse. Sammy is an engineer, and I don't believe he has any contact with his father. They were both raised by Janet's parents. So our sources for this case... A big source was the Nashville Scene series of articles, titled A Good Thing Gone Bad and written by Willie Stern. The New York Times has articles by Theo Emery from August of 2016. And there are two 48 Hours episodes. The first one is Love, Lies, and Murder, and the second one is titled Endgame, which is a follow-up. We also use documents from the Court of Appeals of Tennessee from 2006 and 2013. And there is an episode on the older series, Dominic Dunn's Power, Privilege, and Justice. And the episode on this case is Season 7, Episode 5. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you have comments, a case suggestion, or even a beer recommendation, please send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. Or in our show notes, I will leave a link for you to record a voicemail that you have a pretty good chance we'll play it on an upcoming episode. If you're interested in getting your future TCB episodes commercial-free, getting extra members-only episodes each month, and getting a gift from us, and more than anything, just that good feeling you get from supporting something you love, consider subscribing at tiegrabber.com. Also, if you enjoy the show, we would very much appreciate your leaving a review on iTunes or whatever app you use to listen to us. So time for feedback. Dickie, show me what you've got.
We got two voicemails and two emails.
Wonderful. What would we like to do first?
So the first voicemail is from Robin, who has a suggestion, a general suggestion.
Hi, Jill and Dick. My name is Robin. I'm calling from New Zealand. I am newly premium. I've listened to your podcast for probably the last couple of years now and finally decided to join premium, which is very exciting. Just have a suggestion. With your podcast listening on your Tiegrabber site, it'd be great to see videos as well. I love to be able to see the photos and the pictures of the people that are involved. It just makes it all more real to me. Anyway, hope you're both well. New Zealand is COVID-free. We're living our best lives, and I really hope you guys will be able to do that too. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin. I appreciate that. That's a great suggestion. It's something we can look into. I have considered having like a separate page when a new episode comes out with more pictures and information, so I might get around to that sometime.
I think it might be a good idea. And whenever I read books and study cases for you, I always like to have pictures.
Sure.
And I'm kind of disappointed when there aren't pictures.
Everybody loves pictures, yeah. So that's a good possibility. It'd be a project, but maybe I'll take that on.
We'll see.
Okay. Our next voicemail is from Carol.
She has a case suggestion.
Hey, Dick and Jill. I think an interesting case for y'all to cover would be the murders of Rachel and Lillian Entwistle by the husband, Neil Entwistle. That was back on January 20th, 2006. Be interesting to hear y'all's take on that one. Thanks.
Thank you, Carol. Right to the point. We have covered that case. Was that on the regular show? Is that a premium episode?
I think it was a regular show.
Okay.
It was November of 2018 that we did it.
Okay.
And I remembered that because we got a letter from Entwistle's father, who has written a book about the murder, claiming his son's innocence. And he really reamed us up and down for suggesting that his boy would be a murderer. So that's always stuck in my head.
Well, you know, I have nothing but sympathy for that guy, really.
No kidding.
I can't blame him for trying to defend his son. But yeah, that was a fascinating case. So November 2018, you can hear that.
Yes.
Okay.
And then we got a couple emails. One from Michael.
Okay, so Michael has a case suggestion. Michael writes, I live in Saco, Maine, and here is a case that I feel would be worthy of your examination. Her name was Ashley Ouellette, and in 1999, she was found dead lying in the middle of Pine Point Road. Ashley was only 15 years old when she was murdered. The case was never solved, and it remains open with the state. Rumor is that it is known who killed Ashley, but the police bungled the case so bad that a prosecution would be impossible. The whole thing is really a mystery in our small town in Maine. So I don't know how familiar you are with us, Michael, but we are from Maine, and I actually lived at one point very close to Saco, so very familiar with the area, and have heard of the case.
Yeah, that's why I put it in there. So I haven't done too much research on it yet, but it looked interesting. This was one of those young ladies who, she liked to do things her way. And it was very strong-willed. And he was spending the night at a friend's house and went missing from there. And then they found her body in the road.
Well, Dick, most 15-year-olds want things their own way, in my experience.
Okay.
That's not unusual.
Maybe I shouldn't have said it that way.
No, it's fine to say it, but I think that's not unusual in a teenager.
No.
They're not always the most compliant people.
That's for sure.
Yeah. But definitely a tragic case, and so tragic that if you know who did it, but you can't prosecute them, that's terrible.
Yeah, that'd be tough, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so I'm going to read a little bit about that and see if we can put together an episode on that as well.
Yeah, be like going home.
It really will. I do miss Maine sometimes. So our next email is from Claire. I'm going to have you read that, Dick.
Claire's from New Zealand. She also sent us a voicemail on this case or this suggestion. So I liked her email. There were some difficulties with the voicemail.
Okay.
Anyway, wrongful conviction. I don't think you've covered this, but would love to hear your take. Little old New Zealand case. Ben Smart and Olivia Hope murders disappearance. They've never been found. The guy who got convicted of the murders was Scott Wallace. It was New Year's Eve. We have some witnesses and stuff. The water taxi guy said it was not Scott Wallace who was on his boat, and there are several witnesses to back this. And the boat he dropped these people off at was totally different than the one that Scott Wallace had. Again, lots of witnesses. The police decided the boat so many witnesses saw, and many witnesses came forward saying they saw two kids on board. And the cops tried to coerce witnesses into saying it never existed. Scott Wallace's boat, let alone the image of the boat that the two kids were seen getting into, was totally different. And the images of the person that they got into the boat with was different. Nothing like Scott Wallace. So, nevertheless, he's been convicted. Claire says, check out the documentary, Doubt, the Scott Wallace case.
Oh.
There's other podcasts, too. And he's still in jail.
I love documentaries on wrongful convictions. I'll definitely look that up.
We'll look for it, okay?
Now, next time, Dickie, could you read that with a New Zealand accent for me?
Well, I could try, but I'm not sure I could do a good New Zealand accent.
All right. Well, you work on that and let me know.
It probably sound like I was faking some British accent or something.
Yes, I would make a mess of that. Well, thank you very much, Claire. And that does sound interesting. So I definitely am going to watch that documentary. Hope I can find it.
Let's check.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. We really appreciate it. And thank you for the feedback. That's just amazing.
Always fun.
Yeah. So we'll see you next time at the quiet end.
Got a seat for you right here.
Bye-bye.
Bye.